The Assistant Producer. 1. Meaning? Well, because sometimes life is merely that, an assistant producer. Tonight we shall go to the movies, back to the 30s and down the 20s and round the corner to the old Europe Picture Palace. She was a celebrated singer. Not opera, not even Cavalleria Rusticana, not anything like that. La Slavska, that is what the French called her. Style, 1/10 Tsigan, 1/7 Russian peasant girl. She had been that herself originally, and 5/9 popular. And by popular I mean a hodgepodge of artificial folklore, military melodrama, and official patriotism. The fraction left unfilled seemed sufficient to represent the physical splendor of her prodigious voice. Coming from what was, geographically at least, the very heart of Russia, it eventually reached the big cities, Moscow, St. Petersburg, and the Tsar's milieu, where that sort of style was greatly appreciated. In Fyodor Chalyapin's dressing room there hung a photograph of her, Russian headgear with pearls, hand-propping cheek, dazzling teeth between fleshy lips, and a great clumsy scrawl right across, "For you, Fedusha." Stars of snow, each revealing before the edges melted, its complex symmetry, would gently come to rest on the shoulders and sleeves and mustaches and caps, all waiting in a queue for the box office to open. Up to her very death she treasured above all, or pretended to do so, a fancy medal and a huge brooch that had been given her by the Tsarina. They came from the firm of jewelers which used to do such profitable business by presenting the imperial couple on every festive occasion with this or that emblem, each year increasing in worth, of massive tsardom, some great lump of amethyst with a ruby-studded bronze troika stranded on top like Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat, or a sphere of crystal the size of a watermelon surmounted by a gold eagle with square diamond eyes very much like those of Rasputin. Many years later, some of the less symbolic ones were exhibited at a world's fair by the Soviets as samples of their own thriving art. Had things gone on as they were seeming to go, she might have been still singing tonight in a central heated hall of nobility, or at Tsarskoye, and I should be turning off her broadcast voice in some remote corner of stepmother Siberia. But destiny took the wrong turning, and when the revolution happened, followed by the war of the Reds and the Whites, her wily peasant soul chose the more practical party. Ghostly multitudes of ghostly Cossacks on ghost horseback are seen charging through the fading name of the assistant producer. Then dapper General Golubkov is disclosed idly scanning the battlefield through a pair of opera glasses. When movies and we were young, we used to be shown what the sights divulged neatly framed in two connected circles. Not now. What we do see next is General Golubkov, all indolence suddenly gone, leaping into the saddle, looming sky-high for an instant on his rearing steed, and then rocketing into a crazy attack. But the unexpected is the infrared in the spectrum of art. Instead of the conditional rat-a-ta reflex of machine gunnery, a woman's voice is heard singing afar. Nearer, still nearer, and finally all-pervading. A gorgeous contralto voice expanding into whatever the musical director found in his files in the way of Russian lilt. Who is this leading the infrareds? A woman. The singing spirit of that particular, especially well-trained battalion. Marching in front, trampling the alfalfa and pouring out her Volga Volga song, dapper and daring Jigit Golubkov. Now we know what he had described. Although wounded in several spots, manages to snatch her up on the gallop, and, lusciously struggling, she is borne away. Strangely enough, that vile script was enacted in reality. I myself have known at least two reliable witnesses of the event, and the centuries of history have let it pass unchallenged. Very soon we find her maddening the officer's mess with her dark, buxom beauty and wild, wild songs. She was a belle dame, with a good deal of merci. And there was a punch about her that Louise von Lentz or the Green Lady lacked. She it was who sweetened the general retreat of the whites, which began shortly after her magic appearance at General Golubkov's camp. We get a gloomy glimpse of ravens, or crows, or whatever birds proved available, wheeling in the dusk and slowly descending upon a plain littered with bodies somewhere in Ventura County. A white soldier's dead hand is still clutching a medallion with his mother's face. A red soldier nearby has on his shattered breast a letter from home with the same old woman blinking through the dissolving lines. And then, in traditional contrast, pat comes a mighty burst of music and song with a rhythmic clapping of hands and stamping of booted feet, and we see General Golubkov's staff in full revelry, a lithe Georgian dancing with a dagger, the self-conscious samovar reflecting distorted faces, the Slavska throwing her head back with a throaty laugh, and the fat man of the corps, horribly drunk, braided collar undone, greasy lips pursed for a bestial kiss, leaning across the table, close-up of an overturned glass, to hug nothingness. For wiry and perfectly sober, General Golubkov has deftly removed her, and now, as they both stand facing the gang, says in a cold, clear voice, "Gentlemen, I want to present you my bride." And in the stunned silence that follows, a stray bullet from outside chances to shatter the dawn-blue windowpane, after which a roar of applause greets the glamorous couple. There is little doubt that her capture had not been wholly a fortuitous occurrence. Indeterminism is banned from the studio. It is even less doubtful that when the Great Exodus began and they, as many others, meandered via Sirkeji to Motzstrasse and Rue Vaugirard, the general and his wife already formed one team, one song, one cipher. Quite naturally, he became an efficient member of the WW, White Warriors Union, traveling about, organizing military courses for Russian boys, arranging relief concerts, unearthing barracks for the destitute, settling local disputes, and doing all this in a most unobtrusive manner. I suppose it was useful in some ways, that WW. Unfortunately for its spiritual welfare, it was quite incapable of cutting itself off from monarchist groups abroad, and did not feel, as the émigré intelligentsia felt, the dreadful vulgarity, the Ur-Hitlerism of those ludicrous but vicious organizations. When well-meaning Americans ask me whether I know charming Colonel So-and-so or grand old Count Dikovsky, I have not the heart to tell them the dismal truth. But there was also another type of person connected with the WW. I am thinking of those adventurous souls who helped the cause by crossing the frontier through some snow-muffled fir forest, to potter about their native land in the various disguises worked out, oddly enough, by the social revolutionaries of yore, and quietly bring back to the little café in Paris called Esch Publiki, or to the little Kneipe in Berlin that had no special name, the kind of useful trifles which spies are supposed to bring back to their employers. Some of those men had become obtrusively entangled with the spying departments of other nations and would give an amusing jump if you came from behind and tapped them on the shoulder. A few went a-scouting for the fun of the thing. One or two perhaps really believed that in some mystical way they were preparing for the resurrection of a sacred, if somewhat musty, past. 2. We are now going to witness a most weirdly monotonous series of events. The first president of the WW to die was the leader of the whole white movement, and by far the best man of the lot, and certain dark symptoms attending his sudden illness suggested a poisoner's shadow. The next president, a huge, strong fellow with a voice of thunder and a head like a cannonball, was kidnapped by persons unknown, and there are reasons to believe that he died from an overdose of chloroform. The third president, but my reel is going too fast. Actually, it took 7 years to remove the first two, not because this sort of thing cannot be done more briskly, but because there were particular circumstances that necessitated some very precise timing, so as to coordinate one's steady ascent with the spacing of sudden vacancies. Let us explain. Golubkov was not only a very versatile spy, a triple agent to be exact, he was also an exceedingly ambitious little fellow. Why the vision of presiding over an organization that was but a sunset behind the cemetery happened to be so dear to him is a conundrum only for those who have no hobbies or passions. He wanted it very badly. That is all. What is less intelligible is the faith he had in being able to safeguard his puny existence in the crush between the formidable parties whose dangerous money and dangerous help he received. I want all your attention now, for it would be a pity to miss the subtleties of the situation. The Soviets could not be much disturbed by the highly improbable prospect of a phantom White Army ever being able to resume war operations against their consolidated bulk. But they could be very much irritated by the fact that scraps of information about forts and factories gathered by elusive WW meddlers were automatically falling into grateful German hands. The Germans were little interested in the recondite color variations of emigre politics, but what did annoy them was the blunt patriotism of a WW president every now and then obstructing on ethical grounds the smooth flow of friendly collaboration. Thus, General Golubkov was a godsend. The Soviets firmly expected that under his rule all WW spies would be well known to them, and shrewdly supplied with false information for eager German consumption. The Germans were equally sure that through him they would be guaranteed a good cropping of their own absolutely trustworthy agents distributed among the usual WW ones. Neither side had any illusions concerning Golubkov's loyalty, but each assumed that it would turn to its own profit the fluctuations of double-crossing. The dreams of simple Russian folk, hard-working families in remote parts of the Russian diaspora, plying their humble but honest trades, as they would in Saratov or Tver, bearing fragile children, and naively believing that the WW was a kind of King Arthur's round table that stood for all that had been, and would be, sweet and decent and strong in fairy-tale Russia, these dreams may well strike the film pruners as an excrescence upon the main theme. When the WW was founded, General Golubkov's candidacy, purely theoretical, of course, for nobody expected the leader to die, was very far down the list, not because his legendary gallantry was insufficiently appreciated by his fellow officers, but because he happened to be the youngest general in the army. Toward the time of the next president's election, Golubkov had already disclosed such tremendous capacities as an organizer that he felt he could safely cross out quite a few intermediate names in the list, incidentally sparing the lives of their bearers. After the second general had been removed, many of the WW members were convinced that General Fedchenko, the next candidate, would surrender in favor of the younger and more efficient man, the rights that his age, reputation, and academic distinction entitled him to enjoy. The old gentleman, however, though doubtful of the enjoyment, thought it cowardly to avoid a job that had cost two men their lives. So Golubkov set his teeth and started to dig again. Physically, he lacked attraction. There was nothing of your popular Russian general about him, nothing of that good, burly, pop-eyed, thick-necked sort. He was lean, frail, with sharp features, a clipped mustache, and the kind of haircut that is called by the Russians hedgehog, short, wiry, upright, and compact. There was a thin silver bracelet round his hairy wrist, and he offered you neat, homemade Russian cigarettes or English prune-flavored capstans, as he pronounced it, snugly arranged in an old roomy cigarette case of black leather that had accompanied him through the presumable smoke of numberless battles. He was extremely polite and extremely inconspicuous. Whenever the Slavska received, which she would do at the homes of her various mecenases, a Baltic baron of sorts, a Dr. Bachrach, whose first wife had been a famous Carmen or a Russian merchant of the old school who, in inflation-mad Berlin, was having a wonderful time buying up blocks of houses for £10 sterling apiece. Her silent husband would unobtrusively thread his way among the visitors, bringing you a sausage and cucumber sandwich or a tiny frosty pale glass of vodka. And while the Slavska sang, on those informal occasions she used to sing seated with her fist at her cheek and her elbow cupped in the palm of her other hand, he would stand apart, leaning against something, or would tiptoe toward a distant ashtray which he would gently place on the fat arm of your chair. I consider that artistically he overstressed his effacement, unwittingly introducing a hired lackey note, which now seems singularly appropriate. But he, of course, was trying to base his existence upon the principle of contrast, and would get a marvelous thrill from exactly knowing by certain sweet signs, a bent head, a rolling eye, that so-and-so at the far end of the room was drawing a newcomer's attention to the fascinating fact that such a dim, modest man was the hero of incredible exploits in a legendary war, taking towns single-handed and that sort of thing. 3. German film companies, which kept sprouting like poisonous mushrooms in those days, just before the Child of Light learned to talk, found cheap labor in hiring those among the Russian émigrés, whose only hope and profession was their past, that is, a set of totally unreal people, to represent real audiences in pictures. The dovetailing of one phantasm into another produced upon a sensitive person the impression of living in a hall of mirrors, or rather a prison of mirrors, and not even knowing which was the glass and which was yourself. Indeed, when I recall the halls where the Slavska sang, both in Berlin and in Paris, and the type of people one saw there, I feel as if I were technicoloring and sonorizing some very ancient motion picture where life had been a gray vibration and funerals a scamper, and where only the sea had been tinted, a sickly blue, while some hand machine imitated off stage the hiss of the asynchronous surf. A certain shady character, the terror of relief organizations, a bald-headed man with mad eyes, slowly floats across my field of vision with his legs bent in a sitting position like an elderly fetus, and then miraculously fits into a back row seat. Our friend the Count is also here, complete with high collar and dingy spats, a venerable but worldly priest, with his cross gently heaving on his ample chest, sits in the front row and looks straight ahead. The items of these right-wing festivals that the Slavska's name evokes in my mind were of the same unreal nature as was her audience. A variety artist with a fake Slav name, one of those guitar virtuosos that come as a cheap first in music hall programs, would be most welcome here, and the flashy ornaments on his glass-paneled instrument and his sky-blue silk pants would go well with the rest of the show. Then some bearded old rascal in a shabby cutaway coat, former member of the Holy Rus First, would take the chair and vividly describe what the Israel Sons and the Freemasons, two secret Semitic tribes, were doing to the Russian people. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have the great pleasure and honor. There she would stand against a dreadful background of palms and national flags, and moisten her rich, painted lips with her pale tongue, and leisurely clasp her kid-gloved hands on her corseted stomach, while her constant accompanist, marble-faced Joseph Levinsky, who had followed her in the shadow of her song to the Tsar's private concert hall, and to Comrade Lunacharsky's salon, and to nondescript places in Constantinople, produced his brief introductory series of stepping-stone notes. Sometimes, if the house was of the right sort, she would sing the national anthem before launching upon her limited but ever-welcome repertoire. Inevitably, there would be that lugubrious Old Road to Kaluga, with a thunderstruck pine tree at the 49th verse, and the one that begins in the German translation printed beneath the Russian text, Du bist im Schnee begraben mein Russland, and the ancient folklore ballad, written by a private person in the 80s, about the robber chieftain and his lovely Persian princess, whom he threw into the Volga when his crew accused him of going soft. Her artistic taste was nowhere, her technique haphazard, her general style atrocious. But the kind of people for whom music and sentiment are one, or who like songs to be mediums for the spirits of circumstances under which they had been first apprehended in an individual past, gratefully found in the tremendous sonorities of her voice both a nostalgic solace and a patriotic kick. She was considered especially effective when a strain of wild recklessness rang through her song. Had this abandon been less blatantly shammed, it might still have saved her from utter vulgarity. The small, hard thing that was her soul stuck out of her song, and the most her temperament could attain was but an eddy, not a free torrent. When nowadays in some Russian households the gramophone is put on, and I hear her canned contralto, it is with something of a shudder that I recall the meretricious imitation she gave of reaching her vocal climax, the anatomy of her mouth fully displayed in a last passionate cry, her blue-black hair beautifully waved, her crossed hands pressed to the beribboned metal on her bosom as she acknowledged the orgy of applause, her broad, dusky body rigid even when she bowed, crammed as it was into strong silver satin, which made her look like a matron of snow or a mermaid of honor. 4. You will see her next, if the censor does not find what follows offensive to piety, kneeling in the honey-colored haze of a crowded Russian church, lustily sobbing side by side with a wife or widow, she knew exactly which, of the general whose kidnapping had been so nicely arranged by her husband and so deftly performed by those big, efficient, anonymous men that the boss had sent down to Paris. You will see her also on another day, 2 or 3 years later, while she is singing in a certain appartement, Rue Georges Sand, surrounded by admiring friends. And look, her eyes narrow slightly. Her singing smile fades as her husband, who had been detained by the final details of the business in hand, now quietly slips in, and with a soft gesture rebukes a grizzled colonel's attempt to offer him his own seat, and through the unconscious flow of a song delivered for the 10,000th time she peers at him. She is slightly nearsighted like Anna Karenina, trying to discern some definite sign, and then, as she drowns, and his painted boats sail away, and the last telltale circular ripple on the Volga River, Samara County, dissolves into dull eternity, for this is the very last song that she ever will sing, her husband comes up to her and says in a voice that no clapping of human hands can muffle, "Masha, the tree will be felled tomorrow." That bit about the tree was the only dramatic treat that Golubkov allowed himself during his dove gray career. We shall condone the outburst if we remember that this was the ultimate general blocking his way, and that next day's events would automatically bring on his own election. There had been lately some mild jesting among their friends, Russian humor being a wee bird satisfied with a crumb, about the amusing little quarrel that those two big children were having, she petulantly demanding the removal of the huge old poplar that darkened her studio window at their suburban summer house, and he contending that the sturdy old fellow was her greenest admirer, side-splitting this, and so ought to be spared. Note, too, the good-natured roguishness of the fat lady in the ermine cape as she taunts the gallant general for giving in so soon, and the Slavska's radiant smile and outstretched, jelly-cold arms. Next day, late in the afternoon, General Golubkov escorted his wife to her dressmaker, sat there for a while reading the Paris Soir, and then was sent back to fetch one of the dresses she wanted loosened and had forgotten to bring. At suitable intervals she gave a passable imitation of telephoning home and volubly directing his search. The dressmaker, an Armenian lady, and a seamstress, little Princess Tumanov, were much entertained in the adjacent room by the variety of her rustic oaths, which helped her not to dry up in a part that her imagination alone could not improvise. This threadbare alibi was not intended for the patching up of past tenses in case anything went wrong, for nothing could go wrong. It was merely meant to provide a man whom none would ever dream of suspecting with a routine account of his movements when people would want to know who had seen General Fedchenko last. After enough imaginary wardrobes had been ransacked, Golubkov was seen to return with the dress, which long ago, of course, had been placed in the car. He went on reading his paper while his wife kept trying things on. 5. The 35 minutes or so during which he was gone proved quite a comfortable margin. About the time she started fooling with that dead telephone, he had already picked up the general at an unfrequented corner and was driving him to an imaginary appointment, the circumstances of which had been so framed in advance as to make its secrecy natural and its attendance a duty. A few minutes later he pulled up and they both got out. "This is not the right street," said General Fedchenko. No, said General Golubkov, but it is a convenient one to park my car on. I should not like to leave it right in front of the cafe. We shall take a shortcut through that lane. It is only 2 minutes' walk.
Good. Let us walk, said the old man, and cleared his throat.
In that particular quarter of Paris, the streets are called after various philosophers, and the lane they were following had been named by some well-read city father, Rue Pierre Labime. It gently steered you past a dark church and some scaffolding into a vague region of shuttered private houses standing somewhat aloof within their own grounds, behind iron railings on which moribund maple leaves would pause in their flight between bare branch and wet pavement. Along the left side of that lane there was a long wall with crossword puzzles of brick, showing here and there through its rough grayness, and in that wall there was, at one spot, a little green door. As they approached it, General Golubkov produced his battle-scarred cigarette case and presently stopped to light up. General Fedchenko, a courteous non-smoker, stopped too. There was a gusty wind, ruffling the dusk, and the first match went out.
I still think, said General Fedchenko, in reference to some petty business they had been discussing lately, I still think, he said, to say something as he stood near that little green door, that if Father Fyodor insists on paying for all those lodgings out of his own funds, the least we can do is to supply the fuel. The second match went out, too. The back of a passerby hazily receding in the distance at last disappeared. General Golubkov cursed the wind at the top of his voice, and as this was the all-clear signal, the green door opened, and three pairs of hands, with incredible speed and skill, whisked the old man out of sight. The door slammed. General Golubkov lighted his cigarette and briskly walked back the way he had come. The old man was never seen again. The quiet foreigners who had rented a certain quiet house for one quiet month had been innocent Dutchmen or Danes. It was but an optical trick. There is no green door, but only a gray one, which no human strength can burst open. I have vainly searched through admirable encyclopedias. There is no philosopher called Pierre Labime. But I have seen the toad in her eyes. We have a saying in Russian, «Fisyevoye dvoye iest, shmiet da sovest», which may be rendered thus, «There are only two things that really exist, one's death and one's conscience». The lovely thing about humanity is that at times one may be unaware of doing right, but one is always aware of doing wrong. A very horrible criminal, whose wife had been even a worse one, once told me, in the days when I was a priest, that what had troubled him all through was the inner shame of being stopped by a still deeper shame from discussing with her the puzzle, whether perhaps in her heart of hearts she despised him, or whether she secretly wondered if perhaps in his heart of hearts he despised her. And that is why I know perfectly well the kind of face General Golubkov and his wife had when the two were at last alone. 6. Not for very long, however. About 10 p.m., General L., the WW secretary, was informed by General R. that Mrs. Fedchenko was extremely worried by her husband's unaccountable absence. Only then did General L. remember that about lunchtime the President had told him in a rather casual way, but that was the old gentleman's manner, that he had some business in town in the late afternoon, and that if he was not back by 8 p.m., would General L. please read a note left in the middle drawer of the President's desk. The two generals now rushed to the office, stopped short, rushed back for the keys General L. had forgotten, rushed again, and finally found the note. It read, "An odd feeling obsesses me, of which later I may be ashamed. I have an appointment at 5:30 p.m. in a café 45 Rue Descartes. I am to meet an informer from the other side. I suspect a trap. The whole thing has been arranged by General Golubkov, who is taking me there in his car." We shall skip what General L. said and what General R. replied. but apparently they were slow thinkers and proceeded to lose some more time in a muddled telephone talk with an indignant cafe owner. It was almost midnight when the Slavska, clad in a flowery dressing gown and trying to look very sleepy, let them in. She was unwilling to disturb her husband, who, she said, was already asleep. She wanted to know what it was all about and had perhaps something happened to General Fedchenko. "He has vanished," said honest General L. The Slavska said, "Ah!" and crashed in a dead swoon, almost wrecking the parlor in the process. The stage had not lost quite so much as most of her admirers thought. Somehow or other, the two generals managed not to impart to General Golubkov anything about the little note, so that when he accompanied them to the WW headquarters, he was under the impression that they really wanted to discuss with him whether to ring up the police at once, or first go for advice to 88-year-old Admiral Gromoboyev, who for some obscure reason was considered the Solomon of the WW. "What does this mean?" said General L., handing the fatal note to Golubkov. "Peruse it, please." Golubkov perused, and knew at once that all was lost. "We shall not bend over the abyss of his feelings." He handed the note back with a shrug of his thin shoulders. "If this has been really written by the general," he said, "and I must admit it looks very similar to his hand, then all I can say is that somebody has been impersonating me. However, I have grounds to believe that Admiral Gromoboyev will be able to exonerate me. I suggest we go there at once." "Yes," said General L. "We had better go now, although it is very late." General Golubkov swished himself into his raincoat and went out first. General R. helped General L. to retrieve his muffler. It had half slipped down from one of those vestibule chairs which are doomed to accommodate things, not people. General L. sighed and put on his old felt hat, using both hands for this gentle action. He moved to the door. "One moment, General," said General R. in a low voice. "I want to ask you something. As one officer to another, are you absolutely sure that, well, that General Golubkov is speaking the truth?"
"That's what we shall find out," answered General L., who was one of those people who believe that so long as a sentence is a sentence, it is bound to mean something. They delicately touched each other's elbows in the doorway. Finally, the slightly older man accepted the privilege and made a jaunty exit. Then they both paused on the landing, for the staircase struck them as being very still. "General," cried General L., in a downward direction. Then they looked at each other. Then hurriedly, clumsily, they stomped down the ugly steps, and emerged, and stopped under a black drizzle, and looked this way and that, and then at each other again. She was arrested early on the following morning. Never once during the inquest did she depart from her attitude of grief-stricken innocence. The French police displayed a queer listlessness in dealing with possible clues, as if they assumed that the disappearance of Russian generals was a kind of curious local custom, an Oriental phenomenon, a dissolving process which perhaps ought not to occur but which could not be prevented. One had, however, the impression that the Sûreté knew more about the workings of the vanishing trick than diplomatic wisdom found fit to discuss. Newspapers abroad treated the whole matter in a good-natured but bantering and slightly bored manner. On the whole, L'Affaire Slavska did not make good headlines. Russian émigrés were decidedly out of focus. By an amusing coincidence, both a German press agency and a Soviet one laconically stated that a pair of white Russian generals in Paris had absconded with the White Army funds. 7. The trial was strangely inconclusive and muddled. Witnesses did not shine, and the final conviction of the Slavska on a charge of kidnapping was debatable on legal grounds. Irrelevant trifles kept obscuring the main issue. The wrong people remembered the right things, and vice versa. There was a bill signed by a certain Gaston Coulot, farmer, pour un arbre abattu,
General L and General R had a dreadful time at the hands of a sadistic barrister, a Parisian clochard, one of those colorful, ripe-nosed, unshaven beings, an easy part that, who keep all their earthly belongings in their voluminous pockets and wrap their feet in layers of bursting newspapers when the last sock is gone, and are seen comfortably seated with widespread legs and a bottle of wine against the crumbling wall of some building that has never been completed, gave a lurid account of having observed from a certain vantage point an old man being roughly handled. Two Russian women, one of whom had been treated some time before for acute hysteria, said they saw on the day of the crime General Golubkov and General Fedchenko driving in the former's car. A Russian violinist, while sitting in the diner of a German train, but it is useless to retell all those lame rumors. We get a few last glimpses of the Slavska in prison, meekly knitting in a corner, writing to Mrs. Fedchenko tear-stained letters in which she said that they were sisters now, because both their husbands had been captured by the Bolsheviks, begging to be allowed the use of a lipstick, sobbing and praying in the arms of a pale young Russian nun who had come to tell her of a vision she had had which disclosed the innocence of General Golubkov, clamoring for the New Testament which the police were keeping mainly from the experts who had so nicely begun deciphering certain notes scribbled in the margin of St. John's Gospel. Sometime after the outbreak of World War II, she developed an obscure internal trouble, and when, one summer morning, three German officers arrived at the prison hospital and desired to see her, at once they were told she was dead, which possibly was the truth. One wonders if, in some way or other, her husband managed to inform her of his whereabouts, or if he thought it safer to leave her in the lurch. Where did he go, poor perdu? The mirrors of possibility cannot replace the eye-hole of knowledge. Perhaps he found a haven in Germany and was given there some small administrative job in the Baedeker training school for young spies. Perhaps he returned to the land where he had taken towns single-handedly. Perhaps he did not. Perhaps he was summoned by whoever his arch-boss was and told with that slight foreign accent and special brand of blandness that we all know, "I am afraid, my dear friend, you are not needed any more." And as X turns to go, Dr. Puppenmeister's delicate index presses a button at the edge of his impassive writing desk, and a trap yawns under X, who plunges to his death. He who knows too much, or breaks his funny bone by crashing right through into the living room of the elderly couple below. Anyhow, the show is over. You help your girl into her coat and join the slow, exit-bound stream of your likes. Safety doors open into unexpected side portions of night, diverting proximal trickles. If, like me, you prefer for reasons of orientation to go out the way you came in, you will pass again by those posters that seemed so attractive a couple of hours ago. The Russian cavalryman in his half-Polish uniform bends from his polo pony to scoop up red-booted romance, her black hair tumbling from under her astrakhan cap. The Arc de Triomphe rubs shoulders with a dim-domed Kremlin. The monocled agent of a foreign power is handed a bundle of secret papers by General Golubkov. Quick, children, let us get out of here, into the sober night, into the shuffling peace of familiar sidewalks, into the solid world of good freckled boys and the spirit of comradeship. Welcome, reality. This tangible cigarette will be very refreshing after all that trashy excitement. See? The thin, dapper man walking in front of us lights up, too, after tapping a lookie against his old leathern cigarette case.